you have to be a deep thinker. You have to look at if you're willing to take risks. You certainly have to be willing to know the what if, why not, and why now questions. To me, they're so vital.
Welcome to the Your Living Brand.life show. This show is all about how you communicate your value, how you build influence through trust, and recognizing who your audience is and who they are not. Through our weekly conversations with our guests, we will explore different ways to enable you to demonstrate your uniqueness while we ask them, what's your story? And now, welcome our host, Ben Baker.
Welcome back to another episode of the Your Living Brand.live show. Welcome back, my wonderful audience. Thank you for listening every single week. I appreciate you. Thanks for emailing me at ben@yourbrandmarketing.com. Thanks for connecting with me on LinkedIn. Thanks for telling me about what you like and what you don't like. I love the fact that you just keep communicating with me. It lets me know that you're listening. It lets me know that you care and hopefully that I'm helping you. So this week, I have another wonderful guest for you. Pat Fiore of the Fiore Group and I are going to talk about the power of strategic thinking. Pat, welcome to the show.
Hi, Ben. So happy to be here. Thanks so much for asking me. It's an interesting subject, isn't it?
It's a wonderful subject. I think we're going to have a lot of fun with this. You and I just had a great conversation off air, and we've had lots of great conversations. I mean, we were introduced, I believe, by Chris Nesbitt and Ace Virtual Events. I think you might know we were Junaid and the entire gang, and they were wonderful enough to introduce us, God, months ago. And we've just really grown together this way. But I'd like the world to find out a little bit about you because you've lived a fascinating life and it really will bring us into the power of strategic thinking. So give us a little hint about who you are, where you came from, and what brought you to where you are today.
I grew up in a really old world Italian family and somewhat of a compound because my grandfather was into protecting the family from the world. There was no threats at that time. We lived in Orange, New Jersey. But we had a three-family house and a two-family house. And my grandmother and grandfather had five children. And all five of them, there were actually only five apartments. My grandmother and grandfather lived in the basement so that all five of their children could raise their families in those apartments. I went back about 4 years ago and I saw the apartment we grew up in. And I was astounded at how small it was. I had no idea. It was probably just under 500 square feet, and there were five of us, three kids, mom and dad, living in three rooms until I was about 14 years old. So it's amazing what you can do with your life when that's the life you have. Everything was really more of a matriarch. My grandmother was in charge of everything, and all the decisions were made by her. She was all of about 4'10" and about 70 pounds. There was no doubting that her decision was the right decision. And it didn't matter because that was a decision. My whole family worked in factories. So I was kind of a factory brat as a kid. My grandparents worked on farms, but when they came from Italy, my grandfather worked in the very first Stetson hat factory, which was in Orange, New Jersey, which is shocking to me because they're really cowboy hats in Texas. All the men worked in factories, mostly metals and plastics factories. They were tool and die makers and sewing machine factories. And all the women, my mom, my aunts, all worked in pajama factories. There was a huge pajama factory in the Oranges. So we always had beautiful pajamas. So they all worked as seamstresses. I love being in the factories. There was just something about the rhythm of a factory that really intrigued me. The movement of production from the start to the finish to get it washed, get it dyed, get it washed, get it packed, get it in a box and get it out. I mean, there was just something about the rhythm from start to finish, from thread and fiber to finish, that always intrigued me. My family, the women were all very creative. They made wedding dresses and gowns. And we never bought anything in a store. I don't remember ever having a dress from a store. Everything was made handmade and homemade. So I became very intrigued with fashion. And so my destiny in my mind was to be a fashion designer. So that was my plan. It wasn't the plan my family had for me. They just never really seemed to feel comfortable with that. But I had a great babysitter that I'm a gentleman. I babysat for his children when I was a young girl. And he took me by the hand and got me through the subways in New York and got me to FIT, helped me put my portfolio together because you needed a portfolio to get into FIT at that time. And I got in. And unfortunately, my family was, the women and men believed that when you're a young woman and you have a boyfriend. You get married, you have babies, you stay home. What are you? Maybe you work in a factory a little bit, but there's no reason to have a career. So the career journey was one that I had to pave for myself against all odds. And an Italian family was not an easy thing to do. I'll tell you a cute story. When I was living in New York, paying for school myself to working odd jobs, my aunt had four uncles on one side of the family. They would drive into New York in the middle of the week and park themselves in front of the dormitory just to make sure I was there and not wandering in at 11 or 12. I don't know what they thought I was doing. So I always had chaperones around, even though I didn't know they were there. Occasionally, I'd look out a window on a nice floor in my dorm, and I'd see one of the uncle's cars out there, and I knew they were there for that. They didn't talk to me. They didn't come visit me. They just made sure I was protected. So it was a really interesting time. I love being in design, and there couldn't be enough fabric and lace and trims around for me to play with. I soared to the top of my class. I was in student government at FIT. And at one point, my first semester in school, Mayor Lindsay at that time came to the school and asked for volunteers to go into East Harlem and teach young girls how to sew, because the factories, this is in the late 60s, factories were building up to have fashion made here in the U.S. and not overseas, where fashion came from Paris and France and Italy and not from America. And they were building up the ready-to-wear world, and no one volunteered except Pat. And I got the job. And I spent 2 years teaching four nights a week in East Harlem. I had 16 students that I trained to teach the kids, the young girls that we were going to teach to sew. It was an unbelievable experience. Lots of challenges, but really a great experience. I got a job third semester in school, full-time job. So I went to school part-time my last semester and was working as a fashion designer and loved it. I didn't love the people. I loved the job. I loved the projects. But the people were so different than the people I grew up with and the family that I knew. And it was so challenging that for me, it didn't work. And so out of school, I continued my education at NYU and kept my job as a fashion designer, a young children's wear designer. And then through that, met some very interesting people who thought I had a knack for understanding fashion and looking at fashion. So I think I did. I was more of a problem solver than I was necessarily the most highly creative. But I could, having been experienced in factories and work with a family that didn't have much money but could make everything work, I kind of had this problem-solving perspective on it. Sometimes I could ever see the problem before it even was announced to be a problem and try to fix it before it needed to be fixed. And so I got involved in doing some awareness study, observational research in fashion, and leaped into a job at DuPont, which was just an amazing experience. And the first project they gave me was to go travel to several countries. I had never left the country before. Travel to several countries and observe fashion and report back to them what I was saying.
So how old were you at this time?
1920.
So you were still fairly young. Yes. And being given this responsibility.
Yes.
To be able to go out there and not only go and observe, but bring back the information that you saw in these absolutely amazing foreign countries that you were in.
And like a good, obedient, young Italian girl, I was also engaged to be married. And that was the plan. If you have to go to school, you go. You don't really need to go. But if you want to go, you go. Get it over with and then come back and have the family.
Right.
Live the life. And so it was a 3 or 4 months of traveling. It was amazing to me. And basically, I have my own schedule, a schedule I never ever set before. I'd land and someone would pick me up and they'd drop me off and I'd wander for a while and they'd pick me up and I'd write everything down and wander for a while. So it was really kind of amazing. And then I started doing some forecasting of trends. And this was about the time of the launch of Lycra. And Lycra, the launch failed. And what was so interesting to me was that it failed because it was factory born and development, you know, energized. No one ever asked consumers what they wanted or if they'd like it or if they'd understand it. And so I remember Macy's was filled with thousands of intimate apparel garments and leisure wear and exercise wear, like dance skin, Capizio, Gore-Tex swimwear, all made in Lycra. And of course, Lycra stretches. So that's a wonderful advantage to wear it. When a woman goes into a store and she knows she's a size 8, and she looks at a size 8 and it's this big, and we all know she's going to stretch into it, there's no way she's buying a size 14, so it looks like something she could actually get into.
And there's that perception of, I'm never going to wear a size 14. So you don't buy anything because you think that the 8's going to be way too small, which I should be wearing. Right. And the 14 is going to make me look, I could never tell anybody I was the size 14.
I could never do that. I have to cut the tags that I wouldn't do it. And those days, you didn't try these things on either in dressing rooms the way you do today. You didn't try underwear on, you didn't try on leotards and tights, and you didn't try on bathing suits. So it was really fascinating, and it all failed. And so they came to me and they said, so why, what do you think? And I said, are you kidding me? My mother was a post-war bride, and I'm a post-war baby, and they grew up with mothers who wore things called girdles. No woman's going to put something on that might reflect what her mother was wearing. There's no way. So they can't appreciate it. You didn't do anything to build the brand, build the relationship with women, and to build an understanding of the brand. Years ago, they made it and they hung it up in the store, and women bought it because that's where it was. So it was really fascinating, and they hired me. That's when my business began, because they said, you can do this. And I said, okay, I didn't know I could do it. I was told I could do it, but I had the instincts. When I think of strategic thinking, I think for myself, I think it's about asking the tough questions. I always warn my clients I'm going to do that. And I warn them in that I don't want them to be shocked by something I might ask that they might consider to be off the mark of what they hired me for, the reason they're speaking to me. But you have to be a deep thinker. You have to look at if you're willing to take risks. You certainly have to be willing to know the what if, why not, and why now questions. To me, they're so vital. And I don't know that enough companies, even today, are doing that effectively.
Well, I think that that's a great place to butt in on this, because you're right. Too many companies, first of all, had the mentality back then, hopefully not as much today, but I still see it today. Build it and they will come. And that's not reality. There's too many people out there, whether it be Lycra, whether it be computer software, whether it be anything, they sit there going, a small group of people sit in a room, fall in love with an idea, create a company around it, and are astounded when they fall flat on their face because they have that groupthink mentality.
Absolutely.
And I think that we need to sit there and say, okay, how do we think strategically? How do we think beyond the group that have already fallen in love with something, to get other people to fall in love at the same space? I mean, the perfect book on Lycra is Little Black Stretchy Pants by the guys that started Lululemon. I forgot what the guy who started it. It's about building that movement and getting people to understand that this is good for them and not good for you. So take me through where you went from there. When all of a sudden you were given this task and said, okay, we have this formula, we have Lycra, we built it and they came. How did you take them through the exercise to get them to understand, first of all, that they were not perceiving this as the right problem, and how to get them to figure out what the right questions were to get the right answers?
Well, they were producing an incredible product, and there was no doubt that there was a benefit to them. And the expectation was that the benefit would prove itself. So women will buy it because it's beautiful. And they'll adapt because they can, and they'll learn to love it because they should. And
that's the fashion industry.
And that's the fashion industry. And of course, if you put and attach a wonderful designer name to it, they're going to fall in love with the design, with the look, and they're going to deal with the rest of it. And what I felt strongly about was, number one, we didn't spend enough time. At that time, market research was barely conversation, even were there any stats. So
it wasn't even a word at that point in time.
So I met someone who had her front a magazine, but her husband was doing research for Coca-Cola. And the capability of the computers that he had, I felt could help me with some of this process. So one of the things that I worked on for about a year and a half was the company was getting sales receipts from all over the country and feeding them into the computer. And that information that would spit out would basically say, I'll give you a category. Denim selling on the West Coast, better than selling on the East Coast. It's selling at $49.95 on the East Coast. It's $59.95 And the Midwest is selling at $39.95. So we knew where denim, say, was selling at what price points. We had no idea what it looked like. We had no idea whether it was pre-washed, acid-washed, wide leg, narrow leg, zipper front, fly front, two pockets, somebody's face on the ass. You know, no one knew.
So all you knew was denim.
It was denim.
It was denim. So you had what? You had one data point, which was denim.
One data point. And so what I decided to do was, and I thought I was a little crazy, was hire a bunch of young students out of Parsons and train them to identify style cues. And so while product was being shown at showrooms, they would go in and identify by style number all the style cues. So it had a wide leg, it was acid washed, it was pre-washed, it had a fly front, it had two pockets, five pockets, whatever it was. And then we held that information till sales came in. We matched it by style number. And now we had unbelievable detail. And from that information, I could really predict. I could assess what was selling around the country by look and by style, and then predict where I thought the movement was going to be. And we did this in almost every category of apparel. It was such an amazing opportunity to do this. And it gave me instincts about the tough questions to ask that no one was asking. Everything was dictated. Fashion was dictated. Someone thought you should be wearing mini skirts are in. You wear a mini skirt or you're out. Midi skirts were in, the long skirts that went from thigh high to calf high, calf long, and that's just the way it was. And fashion was always dictating. And women were ready to make some of their own decisions. And that was the transition for me to go from fashion to other categories of products. That was when my business went from being a consultant, being working for DuPont, to being a consultant to DuPont, and many of their customers became my clients, to moving to more predictory work, to moving to other industries that were also affected by emotion, by attitude, by behavioral shifts, by desires, by need, not just want. So there was a big movement at that time in my learning to ask the questions that no one asked at that time. And I started asking them pretty rapidly, and it was really fascinating moving from fashion into general textiles, into fiber, into ingredients, flavors, fragrance, all kind of emotionally driven industries. So I focus on high trending experiential industries and rare technologies. By experiential, it includes food and fragrance and fashion and furniture and anything that emotion drives are the industries that I focus on. And then rare technologies, because I love something intrusive, something that's going to turn the world upside down, providing they have identified the values of it and they really have done their homework to build a great product or a great service.
Hi, everyone. Do you want to be your best customer's vendor of choice? Do you want to cement relationships with them, add real value, and gain insights that your competitors just can't get? Go to podcasthostforhire.com. That's podcasthostforhire.com. And let's work together to make you the value vendor of choice. So do you find that the advent of computers enabled you to be far more strategic? Because 50 years ago, the data just wouldn't have either been available or couldn't have been compiled. Like there would be no sophisticated way to compile that without employing hundreds of people, cross-referencing, and taking months, if not years, to figure it out. And by that time, fashion has moved on.
Right.
So do you find that because you happen to be at the right place at the right time at the beginning of the computer industry and realized that the computational models would enable you to be able to take that data and be able to turn it into logical sequences, into ideas, and into knowledge, was that the real advent that allowed you to be able to be far more strategic?
I think so, but I have to tell you that the approach to the information is not always as predictable. You know, everyone reads information differently and reads it from their own perspective. And so I have great analytical skills. Information has always been important to me. Asking questions and getting answers always important to me. But for me, the observational skill set that I have has made a difference. And so I say that the numbers matter. They do matter. I think the information is important for companies to make change happen, to justify change, to justify production in a different direction. But I really learned on the ground, as I always say, I spent my life in the factories, in the groves, in the fields, on the farms, and in the labs, because that's where everything is born and not always recognized at that moment as something that's going to change the world. But that's where it's born. It's born in the hands of the people that have their hands in the dirt or on the machines or in the chemistry and in the labs. And they're not always welcome to offer an opinion. They're there to produce what is dictated to them generally. But in between what they have to do, there's so much they can do and there's so much that they know that is never discussed. And that's why so often great revolutionary changes in industries don't happen as quickly or as soon as they could, because no one's asking them. No one's watching them.
Exactly. It's asking the right questions to the right people. I mean, data is ones and zeros. That's all it is. Right. It's just a binary yes or no when push comes to shove. It's how do you interpret that data? And the fact that you come from the factories, that you were in the fields, that you were in the labs, enabled you to figure out what the right questions were to ask to be able to interpret that data. And I think that that's what makes you far more strategic. Am I right with that or am I off?
You're absolutely right. And it gave me the guts to speak up and ask the questions that probably no one really wants to answer or no one really knew that was important enough to discuss. So yes, I think it gives me volumes of instinct and intuitive ability. When you're sitting in front of 20 people in a factory and sewing machines, and you know they're having trouble with what they're doing because it's been dictated to be done a certain way, you know that you can tell by their expressions, by their frustrations, by their reluctance to speak up. And at the times I would go there, I would try to go when no one else was monitoring and managing them, and try to intrigue them with my observations of something really wonderful they were doing. And then I would get the confidence, and then I would get the rapport, and then I would get the feedback, but I wouldn't get it any other way. And my predictory work that I've done for years, predicting trends in multiple industries, I'm a deep studier. I mean, I read like crazy. I mean, when I started my business, I took an Evelyn Woods speed reading classes because I was terrified I couldn't keep up with the amount of diversity of industries I was interested in. I didn't focus on one industry, so I wanted to learn. Anytime someone talked to me, I wanted to learn about the industry so I could see if it applied itself to anything else that I knew. So a really voracious learner and reader. And so when I would go and when I would watch, observe people, I would see things that most people wouldn't see. My instincts are really keen. And I think some of that, it may sound crazy, I think it's some of its instincts for growing up in an inner city in a tough neighborhood. I think it's being a single mom, traveling alone all over the world. I never had anyone to go with me. I had my daughter when she was a little older. I took her with me to places, but then I had even more motherly instincts of protection and defense. But being in a man's world for most of my career, there were no women. I owned the largest women-owned agency for 15 years in New Jersey, but that was after putting in 10 years of working, owning the agency. There were not many women that owned agencies. They did some PR, maybe in fashion, more women, but I got honestly, in the agency world, it was predominantly men. And so I had strong defenses, not in an arrogant way, but in a protective way. I was careful about what I said, but I learned by listening and learned by watching and learned by reading. So my intuitive skills are pretty sharp.
Well, and that's insightful in its own, is the fact that through your reading and your observation and where you came from and where you've been, it gives you a wider breadth of information to gather on, to sit there and say, oh, I can see that A relates to B that relates to Q because I've been in all three of those situations, and realize that there is concentric circles that work in a Venn diagram that we can create that allows us to figure out, okay, if we bring a little bit of this to the table, a little bit of this to the table, we can create magic. So my question to you is, as a woman growing up, when you did, in the industry that you did, that you said absolutely was very male-driven, how did you go about creating the opportunities for yourself to be able to be heard and valued within a society that sat there and said, you know what? Yeah, she looks nice in a skirt, but you know what? Does she really have something nice to say, something important to say? And I'm being real blunt about it, but those were the views of people 40 years ago or 30 years ago.
40 years ago. Well, I'll tell you, this is my perspective on it. I always somehow, in some way, had a godfather in every one of these companies. And I think it was typically someone who had wives and daughters in their families. And I could sit in a room with 15 men around a conference table, and there'd be one that would listen differently and afterwards have a conversation with me. My first boss in fashion when I worked for a children's wear company was a man in his, I was 19, 20. He was 66. I went on my first business trip to Worcester, Massachusetts, to the knitting mills with him. And of course, I met with a lot of challenge, even in the factories at that time. And he made sure that everyone listened to what I had to say, not even knowing what I was going to say. We hadn't rehearsed. But he wanted to hear me, and he wanted to watch them respond to me. And I had that at DuPont. I had a wonderful older gentleman who was incredible. And he would shut everybody down long enough for me to say what I had to say. I had that at Celanese, at BASF. And I don't know why. Maybe it's because I'm not confrontational, because I was respectful. Maybe because I didn't really have to talk as much as I do now, but I was listening long enough to, and I would take enough notes and I would study enough. I came prepared. My husband always teases me about how I can walk in a room with a dozen people I've never met and walk out, and he knows them all, tell them a little bit about each one of them, even though I hadn't spoken to them. And I think that, again, those kinds of instincts come from survival skills, an incredibly insatiable desire to learn. I mean, I really love learning. That's the only thing people say to me, are you ever going to retire? I said, if I have to stop learning, no. I want to keep learning. I don't know what I want to learn next, but I know I need to conquer more information and dive into new industries. And I have working with several now that are amazing, that are things I never thought about before. So did I answer your question?
You did, because it's part of strategic thinking that a lot of people don't realize. It's how do you build alliances? How do you read a room? How do you get people to listen, understand, and value what you have to say? How do you build allies? How do you know who are the dissenters? Who are the people that agree with you? How do you get both onto your side? And how do you get people to realize that what you have to say has value? And a lot of it comes to the fact that you come to the room prepared. And I think that whether you're a man, whether you're a woman, whatever you are, I think that if we come to this world and come into every situation with an open mind, with, you know, being prepared, being articulate, and being able to defend in a good way our thoughts, we will find advocates. And I think that that's probably part of strategic thinking that most people don't even realize exists, that it's not just thinking strategically, it's being able to bring your opinions to the forefront and enabling other people to adopt them.
I think you're absolutely right. I'm continuously, even today, inspired by learning something new, by listening to someone new, by meeting new people. I mean, everyone in my staff used to laugh all the time. Whenever we're looking for new business, they'd say, get on a plane, Pat. By the time you get back, we'll have 3 new accounts. And it's true. And it's not that I'm always selling. It's just that I'm open to meeting and listening. I'm intrigued by something I haven't heard before, an industry I know nothing about. People with ideas. I love listening to inventors. And I think I've said to people, my office looks like a Willy Wonka factory. If you should see the things that people send me from all over the world that probably will never have an opportunity to hit the market, but they're interesting. It's interesting to know how they got to that point, their own personal challenges, their own business challenges, their own perspective on what the world needs. But I find it always so intriguing to look at. I always explore the why not? Why not? Why now and why not? And then from that point, how do we make it happen? What if it can? What, how does it change the world? Where's the disruption? I love that, the inventive minds. I love creative people. My last business trip formally before COVID was to Sicily. Spent 2 weeks there. We're trying to help a company that makes nutraceuticals and cosmeceutical ingredients. I spent my days in the groves, the blood orange groves, and they grow artichoke leaves and they grow grape leaves in the ash of Mount Etna, which have healing powers. And the goal was to try to put together a grant proposal to the Italian government to raise money to bring them here to the U.S. Of course, COVID got in the way of that, but we did get the grant money. But I spent my time in that lab and in those fields and in that grove for days. And not necessarily not running a conversation, observing. and watching everyone work and watching the things they did that I never knew, like scratching the skin and smelling it to know if it's ripe. Not about how long it's been on the tree, not how it feels. You smell it. You scratch that skin, you can know. And they do that in the world of citrus. I experienced that in Calabria and Taormina and in Sicily. It's fascinating. And there's something about people that have that skill set that make them really uniquely gifted to make a difference in the world with what they're doing.
We're running out of time, but I have two questions I want to ask you before I let you go. The first question is, if you're talking to somebody who's the next generation, somebody just coming out of school, that 20-year-old, that next 20-year-old, what is the piece of advice you would give him or her when they're thinking about starting their career and thinking strategically?
Learn to listen. Learn to listen and learn to observe, because you're going to learn more by what people don't say than what they say. And oftentimes you're going to learn a lot about the person and the opportunity by the things they tell you. So be willing to dig in deep, listen voraciously, because you need to listen to everyone all the time. And then you'll be able to get inspired. Somewhere along the way, you'll be inspired by something someone says that will lead, I think, open up that path for you and give you an idea of what the journey could be like.
I love that. Pat, the best way to get people to get in touch with you is through the Fiore Group, Fiore Group, correct?
It's just Fiore. It's just Fiore, not Fiore Group.
Yeah.
The company name is PC Fiore and Associates, Inc., and the DBA is Fiore.
Perfect. And here's my last question.
Okay, love it.
When you get out of a meeting and you get in your car and you drive away, what's the one thing you want people to think about you when you're not in the room?
That I really care. That I really care. I want to make a difference. And I'll do the best I possibly can to help them.
You know what? That's all we ever can ever do, is to help people, care, and enable people to be their best. Pat, I love this conversation. I loved having you on the show, and thank you for your insights.
Thank you so much, Ben. This is fun. I hope I gave you everything you need to make this interesting for your listeners.
I know they're going to be listening to this over and over again. Thanks, Pat.
Thanks so much, too. Have a great day.
This has been the Your Living Brand Live Show. I want to thank you for tuning in today. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the show at yourlivingbrand.live and share your favorite episodes with colleagues and friends. At Your Brand Marketing, we help companies engage, retain, and grow their most valuable assets, their employees. If you're tired of losing great staff and want to retain your best employees, build brand champions and leaders at any level. Contact us for a 30-minute consultation at yourbrandmarketing.com. That's www.yourbrandmarketing.com. Thank you again for listening and sharing. Tune in next week when we ask another guest, what's your story?